Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we call it around here, real debate without the hate. Hi there, I'm DJ McGuire. I'm your neoconservative libertarian from Suffolk, Virginia.
I'm Greg Matuszak, your liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio.
I'm Cliff Dunn, your Republican from Virginia.
And I'm Kevin Kelton, a moderate Democrat living in beautiful Southern California.
A More Perfect Union can be found on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And please share our link on your Facebook newsfeed and ask your friends to give us a listen. And before we begin, I would like to congratulate the American Ryder Cup team for defeating the Europeans 17-11 this weekend. Go USA!
USA!
USA! USA! Okay.
Now, as it happened, this is our first podcast since the debate, which was on Monday night. And while we never expected it, Monday night actually ended up being Donald Trump's best of the week, because after that, things just went way downhill.
Yes, the first 38 minutes were his best of the week.
Wow, yeah. And that does not say a lot of his week, then.
I would humbly submit that even the next 60 minutes were better than most of the rest of the week that he's had.
Yes.
But I'm going to say this. How many of these podcasts have we done that started with, this is the worst week that Trump has ever had, or this is Trump's terrible, awful, no good, terrible, awful week?
Very bad.
I mean, it's like he's Teflon. It nothing affects him on these things.
Well, it could mean he's due for a very good one.
It could be.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. We're seeing the damage done to him has been very particular. It's been in Florida and it's been in Nevada. High Hispanic populations in both states. So obviously the whole blow up with the Venezuelan Miss Universe winner obviously had an impact. I think the New York Times story that came out that had him violating the Cuba embargo, that is a crushing blow to him in Florida.
Tell the listeners who maybe aren't, who don't read the New York Times, which I can't imagine who doesn't, what was the what was the Cuba story?
Back in the 1990s, Mr. Trump attempted to do an analysis to see what business could be had in Cuba. He spent about $60,000 to $70,000 on it, and they rerouted it through various charities to make what was an illegal action violating the Cuban embargo look like a legal transaction. Now, there's no evidence that what Trump did is going to get prosecuted, because basically the legal authority that would be involved in that is usually underfunded. This is Al Gore's great no controlling legal authority excuse, which is, yes, I broke the law, but there's nobody around to prosecute me for it, so it's all good. But that sort of thing really hurts you among the Cuban American community, and in Florida in particular. The Republican nominee does not win Florida without carrying the Cuban American community. And Donald Trump cannot win the presidency at all without winning Florida. He needs a bunch of other things to fall in his way. But now Florida seems to be tipping in Mrs. Clinton's direction. And without Florida, there is no way that Donald Trump wins at all ever, period.
That's right.
So there was that. There was the fact that there was the continuing battle over the Venezuelan contestants in Miss Universe. There was the tax return from 1995 that came out that showed he had a loss that was so large that he could essentially avoid paying taxes for the next 18 years, which may in part explain, if that's true, it may in part explain why he's been holding his tax returns close to the vest, not necessarily because it shows tax avoidance, because there's nothing illegal about tax avoidance, but it would just be an acknowledgement.
Well, it's
that
avoidance,
there,
not evasion. That's the difference.
Right.
Exactly.
And a lot of people have been making that argument today, some calling him a genius for being able to utilize all of the tax code to his advantage. But I don't think the point of the story was to suggest that he did something illegal or even nefarious. I think that misses the greater point, which is that if you're a multi-billionaire, which I'm going to take for granted that he is, some people say that's in doubt, but let's say that he's worth several billion dollars, and you're running for president and you're talking about, we've downgraded our military, we've let our infrastructure get run down, but you're not paying federal taxes. There is a contradiction there, a hypocrisy there. That is the greater point. And I was thinking about this today. So let's say that Donald Trump took a very valid $300 billion tax write-off over 10 or 15 or 18 years. Fine. What did he do with that money? Did Donald Trump turn around and give $50 million or $100 million to veterans? Did he donate it to a worthy charity that would put it to use in the inner cities or put it to use? You know, he could have given it to the Pentagon, not that I would expect he would. But do you see where I'm going with this? He has no history in his 70 years of doing anything philanthropic or, you know, for the greater good of mankind. And the fact that he just pocketed that $300 million and then condemns the government for not, you know, for having to go through the sequestration, to me, that's the essence of the story. What do you think, Greg?
Well, my issue isn't so much that, because, you know, it's his money. That's fine. But he has campaigned for the last, I don't know, 10 months that certain companies like Apple have used these same loopholes to move their companies overseas, to move their companies to Mexico, and that nothing they have done is illegal. All they have been doing is saving their company's money. And some would say it would be fiduciarily irresponsible of them not to, which is all fine and good. But now he's been rallying against these companies, which has been un-American and terrible. But now he's been doing the exact same thing.
Well, yeah. the issue, the problem here is ultimately, I would say, with the tax code. I mean, that's fundamentally where the issue is. Now, I'm going to say this.
Yeah.
I've actually wound up in the same boat that Mr. Trump has, because I own a Subchapter S corporation that took a massive loss 1 year. And so
about $1 billion?
Not, believe me, not that big. These were two fairly large investments that blew up. And, you know, the scale is unimaginable to the average person, but at the same time, that's just because the scale of what he is doing really is beyond what I think the average taxpayer would ever come across in their life, short of literally winning the lottery.
I think the thing that Trump has probably been afraid of revealing to the public, and now that it has been revealed, is the fact that he lost $900 million in 1 year. He's been running on his business acumen. He's been running on the notion that he is a smart businessman, that he knows how to move and shake in this economy, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you lose $900 million in a year, it looks like you've been moved and shaken. Not that you're a mover and shaker, number one. Number two, I'm actually going to take issue with something that Kevin said, in that there are a lot of Americans, and frankly, I would count myself among them, who do not automatically deem donation to charity as superior to investing your money in businesses that can provide decent services. Now, Donald Trump is certainly not an active investor. He may be more of a passive investor. But the simple fact of the matter is, he didn't put that money in his pocket. He put it in investment vehicles that would get him a decent rate of return, but that would also provide funds for entrepreneurs who can provide a better mousetrap, as I would say, endless economic classes, but that essentially could provide improvements upon the current array of goods and services. That's not necessarily a bad thing, and that's not necessarily worse than donating to charity. And I would certainly say it is better than just handing it over to the federal government of the United States, which has shown that it really doesn't know what the hell it's doing when it comes to improving upon the current slate of goods and services. So I'm not necessarily going to criticize Donald Trump for what he chose to do with his money that he was not handing over to the federal government. I think the bigger problem for Trump is that he is now, that everyone has now seen that he lost $900 million in 1 year, and the folks who would look at him and say, oh yeah, he's a good businessman, have to look and go, wait a minute, do good businessmen really lose $900 million a year? That's an open question.
Okay. Now, I just want to point something out, by the way.
Okay.
I'm looking at the pages that the New York Times procured and released. And, you know, Trump has made this point that he has a fiduciary obligation to the shareholders in his businesses to take that tax write-off. This is the income tax return of Donald J. Trump and Marla Trump, okay? This is not the return of Trump Entertainment. This is not a corporate return. It is a resident income tax return. Do you take corporate write-offs on an individual return?
It depends on the nature of the corporation. If it's a subchapter S, yes, it passes through. If the subchapter C that gets more complicated, and we would probably need an accountant on the show for the evening just to go over it in detail, I don't know how he actually holds these companies, i.e. are they held in the form of trusts that then in turn own the companies, and thus things pass through. Basically, there are a lot of very complicated, completely valid, I will underline, and actually not abnormal structures that could be used that would result in this passing through or not, depending on exactly how he set things up or how his lawyers and accountants set things up.
Okay. Yeah, let's be clear. Trump did not actually set any of this up himself. It was a team of lawyers.
That caveat.
Right. So when Rudy Giuliani and Chris Christie say he's a genius, he's no more of a genius than I am when my tax accountant tells me, oh, you've got a deduction for your home. Oh, I forgot, mortgage interest is deductible. You know, so he is not a genius. He simply has smart people who find these loopholes for him.
But that's been his tagline for his entire campaign, is he's got the greatest people around him. So maybe.
Yeah, no, that's been his tagline. But I mean, I just hope that our audience knows how silly that is.
Yeah, Kevin, Greg said that was Trump's tagline. He didn't say you had to believe it.
Right. I was just saying.
Now, to be fair, Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton both had a very bad faux pas this week, or at least I define it as a faux pas, when they declared that Angela Merkel, the woman who flattened several Mediterranean and Ireland's economies for the sake of the euro and has steered the ship of state known as the Federal Republic of Germany into the iceberg of the potential Deutsche Bank collapse, is actually a leader that they admire. Whereas Gary Johnson insisted that it be Vicente Fox, even when he could not remember his name and risked making himself look terrible for a minute and a half until that name was pointed out to him. I haven't spun like that in years. Man, that felt good.
I was going to say.
So wait, what is your point? That Merkel was not a good person to pull out of the hat?
No.
That is a point. Humor aside, I do not think Angela Merkel is a leader that anyone should admire. I think she has a very poor record.
Well, who would you pick, DJ? Let's do it here.
Okay, fine. I actually think the current Prime Minister of Great Britain, Theresa May, although she hasn't been there particularly long, she has really shown what good leadership is like. You all may know how much I admired Margaret Thatcher during her time as Prime Minister.
Okay, we're going for living.
Let's go for living. Yeah.
No, that's fine. We can go for living. I think Francois Hollande in France is very badly underrated. I very much like the new president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen. She is a very good advocate for her country in a very difficult political situation.
I'll throw one more out for you.
But I don't like them.
For all our Japanese listeners, Shinzo Abe. I like Shinzo Abe.
I'm not so certain that turning on the money spigots is necessarily the best thing to do for the Japanese economy. But their economy has been doing well.
Okay, I want to follow up on this.
Our listenership, for the record, our listenership in Japan is going to go booming now.
Yes.
Just I'm going to throw that out.
I want to stay on this topic, but I want to first just ask Cliff if he has any names to add. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I just don't want to leave anybody out.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, we've run through a lot of the prominent lists. I would say that Angela Merkel is probably close to my least favorite world leader right now. Like I said, I'm a big fan of Shinzo Abe. The president of Mexico, Peña Nieto, I think it is. Yeah. I may be mangling that. He's had corruption issues, but he's been doing a lot better than Fox did and Calderon did with the drug war, at least.
So here's why I asked everybody to state some names. It seems like all we've come up with is not me, but many of the people here dislike Angela Merkel. May turn out to be okay, but she's way too new. Trudeau may be too new. My point is, if we can't name a foreign leader that we can unabashedly say is doing a good job, what does that say about our leaders? I mean, everybody is so critical of Barack Obama and blame him for everything bad that's happening in the world. Maybe it's just a more difficult world to control, and it's not a good time to be a world leader.
Yes and no. I mean, this is not the easiest time to govern a country. I mean, the 1990s, one could argue, was an easier time to do that sort of thing. But
heck yeah, you got more shoes, that's for sure.
you can still play the hand that you were dealt very, very badly. And
but if everybody is playing a bad game, then why is it only Barack Obama that gets nailed by the right? I'm just trying to point out that in this process that we're now in of choosing our next president, I think we have to take into account that it's a bad time to be trying to take credit for what's going on in the world. And no one president, no one foreign leader, no one secretary of state should be pinned with everything bad that's happening in the world, because the whole freaking world has created it.
And you're right. They should not be blamed for everything that has gone wrong. They should be blamed for the things that they have done wrong. And while you and I may disagree, I think there is a very long list of the things the president has done wrong. I think there's a rather long list of things that Hillary Clinton has done wrong. And just because this is a difficult time to lead does not necessarily mean that you're going to fail as a leader. You can take a bad hand and play it well. What I would criticize the president for doing, and to some extent Mrs. Clinton, because she was Secretary of State during his first term, is that they made a lot of decisions and a lot of mistakes that made a bad situation worse. They did not have to just pull out of Iraq in 2011 because al-Maliki was throwing up some conditions.
I want to stop you on that. You brought that up last week.
I did, let me make my point before you refute it.
Okay.
When stuff like that happens, you make a counteroffer. You hammer out arguments back and forth. You see what happened. I firmly believe that the president used al-Maliki's demands as an excuse to pull out of Iraq as soon as possible, because that's what he really wanted to do. He used the Iraqi government's demands as an excuse to pull out, rather than use them as a basis to make a counteroffer and begin some serious negotiations. He wanted to leave. He had his excuse. He left. And now, by the way, he's coming back in. He even introduced 600 more troops into the retaking of Mosul.
DJ, do you think that al-Maliki was posturing, or that he really wanted the U.S. to get the bleep out?
I think he was posturing in part. I think there were parts of his governing coalition that probably wanted us out, but I think there were parts of his governing coalition that definitely wanted us in.
Okay, so that was actually the point that I was going to, as you said, refute your point. And Cliff, you kind of laid some groundwork for me there. You know, we're never going to agree on what was happening in Iraqi politics. We could barely agree what's happening in United States politics.
True.
But my distinct memory, and I really read up on this at the time because I heard the argument that you've made many times, DJ, and I think it's a false argument. The deadline that the Bush administration negotiated was coming. The Obama administration did make attempts to convince Maliki to go to his parliament to rewrite the rules of legal engagement so that our troops could stay there without being subject to the laws of Iraq, which is the sword of Damocles that was hanging over us. The parliament was adamantly against changing that. The parliament was not going to give Maliki what he needed to negotiate a deal. So when you say Obama used it, or he was half-hearted in the negotiations, and again, frankly, I'll acknowledge Leon Panetta.
Leon Panetta. Okay, go on.
If you know, he says he doesn't think that the Obama administration pushed as hard as they could. But the reality was, we could sit here all day and say, had Obama gone back a second time, a third time, a fourth time, maybe he could have gotten a better deal. That's like what everybody says about the Iranian deal. Oh, we didn't negotiate hard enough. We could have gotten a better deal. That's after the fact, 2020 hindsight, second guessing. The reality was, the Iraqi government was never, well, told us they were not going to allow our troops to stay there with any type of an immunity clause, and Obama took them at their word. He tried, he pushed back, they said no, and that was it. Now, for Maliki, it was a horrible mistake, but don't blame Obama for that. It was Maliki's mistake.
Last question about this, and going way, way, way back. This is the second time that Gary Johnson made a major flub.
I wouldn't go that far.
It was. I mean, and for the most people, it was an optic flub. Okay?
Bad optics, fine.
Bad optics. Does this waver at all, in the slightest, your determination to see him one day in the White House.
No, it doesn't. He couldn't remember Vicente Fox's name. Right. He should have remembered Vicente Fox's name. No dispute there.
He should have. But here's the thing.
Both of these errors and both of these failures on Johnson's part have been foreign policy failures. Now, I'll be honest. I don't agree with Gary Johnson on a lot in foreign policy. Unfortunately, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and Barack Obama do. Because the same day that Gary Johnson didn't know what Aleppo was, he stated a policy that not only did Trump and Clinton agree with the policy, but Barack Obama actually implemented the policy when he attempted that bizarre ceasefire in negotiating with the Russians a day after Johnson couldn't remember what Aleppo was. So the simple fact of the matter is Johnson actually, painful for me, represents a growing consensus on foreign policy, with which I don't agree. But more to the point, his foreign policy failures, his foreign policy knowledge failures, don't change the fact that he is head and shoulders above both major candidates on domestic policy, and that both major candidates, one major candidate does stuff that should embarrass most Americans, in my opinion, your mileage may vary, and the other would move the country in a direction that I just simply cannot countenance going. Hillary Clinton will very competently bring disaster upon disaster to the country. I genuinely believe that. Hillary Clinton will enact incorrect government policies and carry them out frightfully well. Donald Trump will make some correct policies, some incorrect policies, and he will implement them frighteningly incorrectly.
Okay, so I just want to point out for any of our liberal listeners who may be wavering on voting for Hillary Clinton because you don't think she's progressive enough, you just heard a neoconservative tell you that she will implement policies that he hates. In other words, really good progressive liberal policies, and she'll do it effectively. So thank you for endorsing Hillary Clinton.
I'm DJ McGuire, and I approve this bizarrely backhanded compliment, I think.
If I just did a mic drop. Now, okay, but you know, we've had a very high-minded conversation about foreign leaders, frankly, probably a little wonky. Let's get back to making fun of Hillary and Donald, shall we? Because that's really the fun of this show.
And that's our bread and butter.
That's our bread and butter, and I'm about to butter it on both sides, frankly.
And sadly, I just ran out of booze.
At the end of the debate, Donald kept saying, you know, I could go there, but I'm too classy to go there because I'm a nice guy, and I won't talk about going there, you know, there.
I'm not going to say anything about Bill Clinton having had sex multiple times in the White House with a 24-year-old, because that wouldn't be classy.
That wouldn't be classy, and I'm a classy guy. But so the question tonight that I'll pose to y'all, is that fair game? Is the fact that the spouse of a candidate's infidelities, is that fair game?
Yeah, I would say yes, if only because so much of Hillary's initial political persona was built around standing by her man and so forth. This is not a case of they were both private people and Bill happened to have an affair 20 years ago. This was all very much a part of the public record. She was standing there at press conference after press conference, et cetera, et cetera. So I think if you want to say Donald Trump's 1995 tax return is fair game, then Hillary Clinton standing by Bill Clinton in 96 and 97 definitely is.
I think that aside from Cliff, who I love but I disagree with on this, everybody in the world, including Donald Trump, has already acknowledged it's not fair game. And that's why they're not going to posture it as being about Bill. They're posturing it as being about Hillary attacking the women. Because they can't go after Bill, because everyone in the world knows it's inappropriate to do that. He is a spouse. He's not the one running for president. And it would be the height of hypocrisy to punish that woman who's been through hell in her marriage to now lose the presidency because her husband stepped out on her.
Yeah, how is this any different from when Geraldine Ferraro's husband's tax returns came up? And her, you know, how is this any different from that being an issue in 1984?
Well, it shouldn't have been an issue then. Spouses shouldn't have been off base.
It was terrible.
Unless she signed the tax return, it should have been off base.
Okay, first of all, the tax thing that killed the Democratic ticket in 1984 was Walter Mondale saying he would raise them, not Geraldine Ferraro's husband filing them.
Very true.
Secondly, I would humbly submit, if I can be flippant with the metaphor, Bill's infidelities may very well be fair game, but they're fair game that Donald Trump is going to lose.
Yes.
Because most Americans don't see that as particularly important. And frankly, they are the wrong thing for Donald Trump to go after Hillary for. If you want to go after an issue in Hillary and Bill Clinton's past, what you go after is Whitewater and Madison Guarantee. They drove a real estate company into the ground. Their business partners drove a savings and loan into the ground. And she magically was in position to represent the government in its attempt to recoup bailout money from that savings and loan, and she settled for pennies on the dollar. That's what you go after her for, not as a potential enabler of Bill Clinton's affairs, because they have a very different marriage. Their marriage is based on their shared political bonds and political ambitions far more than most other marriages are. Hey, that's their marriage. If that works for them, that's fantastic. You go after her role in enabling the Arkansas political machine, where she does have dirt under her fingernails. But Donald Trump can't do that for two reasons, or for one reason. And the main reason is because if she goes after her part in a corrupt political machine in Arkansas, then she can go after his part in the corrupt political machine in New York. And that's why he doesn't do it. Instead, he does idiotic, clumsy things like, to use the mafia terminology, nice marriage you have there. It's a pity if something happened to it. It's not going to work. It's not the weapon he should use, but it's the only weapon he can.
But isn't it sad that we're sitting here talking about what people should go after, what weapons they should use? I mean, I know I'm being Pollyannish here, but oh my God, we're 5 weeks out from Election Day, and these people have to figure out how to torpedo each other instead of talking about what they would do or why people should vote for him. Now, again, I might as well be playing a violin.
But Kevin, yeah. Let's be honest. We're talking about Donald Trump here. Hillary Clinton has been relatively clear on what she wants to do for the country.
Right.
It's why I'm not voting for her. Donald Trump can't be that clear, partly because I don't think he knows half the time what he wants to do for the country. So this is what he has to do. And he's doing it.
Well, this is what
I would
he has
say,
to
you know,
do.
Yeah, you know, this may not necessarily be a reflection of the weakness in the American body politic, although there is an argument for that to be made, as much as it is about how weak Donald Trump is as a candidate. And it says something about the rut that the Republican Party is in and whether or not they should just declare Chapter 11, close up and move on with their lives, in that of the 17 people that put themselves forward, this was the person they thought was their strongest candidate.
Well, I'm not sure that there was any rational thought to it. I think it just happened that way. But anyways, I'm going to wrap things up because we've had a great show tonight, I think. And we have another one coming up on Tuesday. We're going to be doing a special edition of A More Perfect Union after the vice presidential debate. So please look at your downloads and listen to us then as well. Please send us your questions at moreperfectunionpodcast.com, where you can also find our blogs and our host bios. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. And if you enjoy political debates and would like to be part of ours, join us on Facebook in our political discussion group, Open Fire. We're all there, and we'd love to see you there, too. Guys, any last thoughts before we say goodbye?
No, I'll see you guys at the debate. Online, I hope. And it should be exciting. The Kadenator against Pence.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, folks.
The Kadenator.